Oh, this is WBAI in New York City. I wonder if they mean that I'm the old lady here. This is Radio Unnameable. It's midnight in New York and in a few other places, too. And it's a hot night. You know, do you remember back before there was global warming? We used to have something called the long hot summer. Remember that? Whatever happened to the long hot summer? It's been replaced with global warming. Now, global warming is because the ice caps are melting. I wish that I could do something about the control room that's leaking into my earphones. I think I have an idea of why that's happening. I went to, for one of my long midnight walks through the city. I do love to take those long walks through the city of New York. On a hot night, I would just like say, I gotta get out of this pad. There's no air conditioning. And I remember one time there was a party in like the hottest part of the summer in this little building that looked like it was something out of the Honeymooners in New York City. I mean, it really looked like the same sink. It was a tiny little apartment, and it really wasn't hard. This is a terrible way to describe an apartment. I mean, animal cruelty lurks in this metaphor, but there wasn't room to swing a cat. It was a small, small apartment. And it was hot, and yet they had a party in the building. There was a guy who was from India, and he told me about the Jews of India. He said there have been Jews living in India since maybe the 13th century, and they have a community, and they, you know, and he was a filmmaker in New York, and he gave me a film about the colony that I once actually played on the air. And there were a lot of, like, artistic types in the building. And, you know, like, New York City used to be, when rents were cheap, used to be a place where people who were struggling to have careers in the arts could, you know, find some kind of a cheap place and, like, go back and do their work. And there was this guy who lived in the building. He's dead now, so I guess it's okay to say his name was Arturo. And Arturo, I don't want to say that he fancied himself. Someone actually fell asleep in this room, and I'm banishing them. I am banning them unless they can manage to stay awake while I tediously go on with my story about Arturo, the opera singer, because in a way it's relevant to an experience I had this week. Arturo liked to dress up in costumes, you know, ruffled collars and wigs, curly wigs, and sing his opera, standing usually on a chair in his kitchen. You know, also in the kitchen was a bathtub, so I guess he got some really good reverberation in the bathtub, and he loved to do this. This was how he practiced his art, like so many of the people who are struggling to have careers in the arts in Manhattan, or were before the rents got to be, like $2,400 for a little two-room apartment shared by four people, you know. But more of that, or less of that later. One time I knocked on Arturo's door because I had taken pictures of him at this party, you know, when he was dressed up in his ruffled costume and his pantaloons, and he was singing from the Marriage of Figaro, and it was really kind of charming and beautiful, although, you know, his range wasn't all that great, you know, and he didn't have that bel canto thing that they strive for, but he strove for it. He was a struggler, was Arturo. And I saw him drilling holes in the floor of his kitchen with a brazen bit, drilling holes in that costume, squatting there in the kitchen, drilling holes in the floor. And I said, "Arturo, what's going on?" And he said, "I'm going to bend her to my will." I said, "Arturo, what do you mean?" I said, "I sing beautiful music, and she pounds on the ceiling. I'm going to bend her to my will." And he poured Drano down the hole in the floor. "Drano?" I said, "Arturo, you're crazy. That stuff is poison. It's going to come back and fill your room." "I don't care. It's worth it." I said, "But Arturo, your voice, you don't smoke cigarettes because you're dedicated to preserving your voice." And he said, "I don't care. I'm going to bend her to my will." And I remember this week, I believe it's the anniversary of the time a president who tried to bend the United States of America to his will. Richard Nixon. "I'll make them support the war. I'll make the American people want to die for me and my guys." And he said he was going to bend them to his will, and he wanted to make sure that the Democrats didn't win the election. And so he sent his guys into this big hotel that had just been built in Washington, and he had them put tape on the door, and this guy, Frank Wills, discovered the tape. And he said, "Gee, that's funny." And he took the tape off. And then he came back an hour later, and there was tape there again. So he said, "I think I better call the police." And he called the police, and Howard Hunt, and, Zagretti, and, you know, all those other guys were exposed as the Watergate burglars. Remember that? And what finally happened as a result of that, if you remember, if this tape player plays correctly, and I have no reason to believe that it will, where is it? You're supposed to press the button, and it's supposed to work, right? Didn't happen. Oh, it's because of my inadequacy. Now it's not playing, but that's not my fault. I don't know why, but... Everything is just as it should be, but the tape isn't playing. Well, anyway, we were going to have... could it be switched? Nope. None of them seems to be working properly. I tell you why. Actually, what's happening now is another control room is being fed in through the monitor because the standards of engineering around this place have so improved. Well,
original process here we go. To its conclusion that it otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process. and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged. I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation would require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first.
Oh. The man in the arena.
face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, because there is not effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deed, who knows the great enthusiasm, the great devotion, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumphs of high achievement, and with the worst, he fails, at least fails, while daring great. I pledge to you tonight, as long as I have a breath of life in my body, I shall continue in that spirit. I shall continue to work for the great causes to which I have been dedicated throughout my years as a congressman, a senator, a vice president, and president. The cause of peace, not just for America, but among all nations. Prosperity, justice, and opportunity for all of our people. There is one cause, above all, to which I have been devoted, and to which I shall always be devoted for as long as I live. When I first took the oath of office as president 5.5 years ago, I made this statement.
You get the idea, you know. He stood up in front of everybody and said, well, you know, I better go for the good of everybody. And you got to admire a guy like that. He had some class, right? Didn't want to wreck the country. That's what he said, anyway. Of course, what was probably going on was Alexander Haig was behind the curtain holding a gun on him and saying, I'm in charge here. Remember that? Probably don't, but maybe you'll see a movie about it someday. It was a great day in the world. Now, today wasn't such a great day in the world. There was an explosion in a pizza parlor, you know, the ultimate way of trying to coerce someone to bend them to your will is to set off a bomb in an area with civilians. You know, it's sort of like all of a sudden some maniac like Baruch Goldstein or Bernard Goetz is not enough, you know, for Kali. And Kali lets loose in the world some kind of what they used to call kind of a device, was it? An atrocious device that would commit atrocities on civilian populations. Of course, bombing Dresden, Nagasaki, which we also commemorate this weekend, or other atrocious ways to bend others to your will. Not a very good thing, you know. People should try to work it out. I mean, I hear people saying, anarchists should be disciplined. I mean, that's what anarchists are supposed to be, disciplined. But how can anyone be disciplined in an atmosphere of coercion and intimidation and fear and racism? I mean, how is that possible? I guess it's possible. But it's very difficult, you know. You have to really care about the mission, as they say, to stick around in the face of that. This morning, on Radio Unnameable, we have some music by Odetta. We're expecting some live music. There's someone named Sharif who said that he would be coming up. He is a freestyle rapper. And his gift, or his great art, is to make up a rap about something that just happened a few moments before. And I said, hey, wouldn't that be sort of an interesting thing to have on a telephone show where you had a whole bunch of people calling up and talking about something like, I don't know, the peace process in what's left of that part of the world, and the peace process in what's part of the other part of the world. And, you know, to rap about it might be terrific. Expected him. I don't see him here yet, but we'll see. Sooner or later, he'll be here. We probably will get a regret from him. But there have been a lot of causes for regret in the world. You must have some opinions about what's called the peace process in Ireland, John. John McDonough is here with us this morning.
I don't know if we're allowed to give opinion. I think we have to give unbiased fact. Is that the...
Well, you have to get a release.
Well, there's a lot of things going on in, I guess you could say, the Middle East, and on a far smaller scale, what's going on in Ireland with the...
Yeah, but, I mean, aren't the same... Isn't the same peace plan falling apart in both places? I mean, sort of identical, you know, ways to bring people to the peace table.
Yeah, but the negotiating stakes are higher in the Middle East with, like, what you said happened today, and then even with the bombing in London, it's, you know, it's a difficult way to negotiate when things like that are going on, but that's always been part of the process, isn't it? And that's how most people get to the table. Most groups, they bomb their way to the table, and they go and negotiate from there.
Mm. Well, does this mean that there is a group that's not taking part in the peace process that wants to have a seat at the table? Or does this group want to blow up the table?
Well, it doesn't want to be part of the table.
You can't make peace with people like that. Well, the British are still here. How can you have peace?
But, Bob, it's the table and what's on the table. A lot of people might even say the table's not even worth blowing up because there was nothing on it in the beginning of the process to blow it up for.
Yeah, but there are people, you know, in the area of the explosion, flesh, blood, you know, it's something you try to avoid, don't you?
Well, it depends, because I heard the Israelis reacted to that horrific bombing that happened in Jerusalem today. And
by more bombs, right?
Well, yeah, but they have a great new term they use when they're going after
we'll
someone.
We'll teach you to kill us.
No.
We'll kill you. That will teach you. You'll learn that lesson.
But you know what? A great term.
You'll never do that again.
Out of wars, you get a very good terminology of collateral damage and things like that. The new word coming out of the Middle East when you go out and kill someone, it's called active self-defense. Which I thought was a pretty good word, that when they went out and missile attacked some cars in the West Bank, they said, well, they might not have been going to do a bombing, but we had intelligence reports that they were going to do a bombing, so we took what's known as
and if they had bombs, they really would have been dangerous if they'd known where to get them, but we haven't given them bombs yet.
So active
self-defense.
Because,
you see, that's my understanding of how this whole thing works. That the Palestinians get their guns with money that they get from the Israelis in some cases that has come from the United States. And it's all from the United States. That I wouldn't be surprised if the both sides in the Irish Republic were being armed one way or another by the United States.
Well, it's the case in Iraq and Iran when we armed and funded both sides when they were slaughtering each other in their little border war there for about 8 years. And you can be sure a lot of the weapons that are used in Ireland did originate here illegally on one side from the United States and legally for the other side. in Ireland that came from the United States. We have a big business in arms manufacturing, and we don't take political sides when people want to buy, especially if it's a state government, they can buy whatever they want. And if it's illegal organizations or deemed illegal by those governments, they seem to be able to maneuver and get weapons from this country, although now it seems the hotbed for purchasing weapons is in the Balkans. It seems to be an arms bazaar. You go down to Albania.
We're practically giving them away.
That's the deal that's going on down there now, because this is all I hear about. People with Irish accents going around the Balkans and Albania looking to bring stuff back up to England and Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we put a stop to it? You know, I have a friend who used to say, Jews and Arabs and Christians unite to smash the state.
Which state?
All states.
Well, that ain't going to happen.
That's what they said about television. How can you send pictures through the air? Well, maybe, you know, if you send enough pictures of something like that through the air into people's heads, they'll say, hey, wait a minute, why am I paying half of my life's wages to some terrible government that knows nothing better to do than to send garbage cans into space and kill people here on Earth? I mean, that's got to be a better way to spend our money.
Well, you know, especially with the news, if it bleeds, it leads. And what you're talking about doesn't sound like anybody bleeding. So you'll be put back in the entertainment part of the news, which is, I guess, the majority of the news, unless you get on for that first minute. But, Bob, it should all be as easy as you say it is. And is that your music, Bob, or is that coming from the other studio?
Oh, stop that. Stop that. Stop that music. Stop that music. Stop that music.
Oh, well, stopping the music on a video camera, which could be deemed an illegal weapon up at the studios of WBAI. I don't know if Bob has permission to videotape himself here, but he'll keep pressing on.
I have a tape I brought in that I might want to play, too. I think it's from a time when the manager of WBAI chose to go to jail rather than give up a tape that had come from some of his listeners. The district attorney wanted Ed Goodman and the news department and Dolores Costello to turn over tapes that had come from the Weather Underground to be used in prosecution. And Ed Goodman said, we're not allowed to. I mean, we have ethics as news people. Sources are sacred. News is sacred. And he actually went to jail for a few days until they appealed to a higher court. Those were the days, you know. Now listeners are being sent to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you must have an idea of what's going on that transcends what's been printed in the New York Times.
Well, basically it's just been teetering along, and every day you read, especially in the weekly Irish American papers, and we always say that at the beginning of the year there'll be at least 42 headlines that the peace process is in crisis, literally every week in the headlines. But what's going on now is the dismembering of the Irish Republican Army, and they're surrendering. They're in the last phase of their struggle. The struggle for United Ireland is over for them. They're just now negotiating the modes of how to destroy the weapons that came from this country that were sent over to prosecute a war to bring about a United Ireland are now being used as a bargaining chip in order for Provisional Sinn Féin to administer British rule in Ireland.
But is this a monolith, the Irish Republican Army?
No, there's different variations.
And different attitudes towards surrendering the weapons.
Well, there's the Provisional IRA, who are in control of the majority of the weapons, who want to surrender the weapons. Then there's the Continuity IRA and what's being termed the Real IRA, who are keeping the struggle going as far as they see it for United Ireland, believing the way that Gerry Adams, who's the head of president of Provisional Sinn Féin, will not get to the promised land of United Ireland, that he's accepted British rule, and that he will administer British rule in Ireland and be paid by the British government in order to do it. It just doesn't come out as blunt as that, but the end result is the same. So we're going to have a scenario right now of cement trucks going around Ireland to IRA arms dumps and cementing in the bunkers. As we termed it on Radio Free Erin, and the new phase of the struggle will now be called the concrete retreat, as people will be following around these cement trucks as they seal in the bunkers.
Or Giuliani's dream.
Yeah, well, Giuliani would be happy, and there's a lot of Irish-American politicians are happy this is going on, and, you know, we have the economic pacification of the people in the six counties. Money that was never available for 30 years is now being pumped into that part of the country, hoping that the people, if they can raise the standard of living to a somewhat living standard, that they might not be that hostile and go out into the streets and go out and riot and go out and petrol bomb and do other nasty things like that against the state. But that hasn't been proven true in the past month or so, since we're in the middle of the marching season over there. There's been as intense riots as ever there have been in Ireland in the past 30 years that are going on in Belfast and throughout the six counties, and now the sectarian killings have started up again by the Loyalist death squads. So while all this is going on, the Provisional IRA, in their wisdom, have saw fit to issue a statement this week that they will be surrendering their weapons on behalf of the British government in order to have their political masters get into a British parliament, which sits outside of Belfast, and so their political masters can administer British rule in Ireland. But it's not going to go as easy. There'll be a few bumps in the road, just what happened in Ealing in London, a little bump in the road there, that there'll be Irish men and women that are not going to accept what's going on over there, and they're going to continue on and challenge the state and go to jail and just keep fighting on until they get a United Ireland. It's just not going to be as easy as we read in the newspapers.
Well, what about the British? Are they going to lay down their arms?
Oh, no. That's not even on the table, as I was saying to you. That's not part of the equation.
Well, something wrong with that, you know. You live in an atmosphere where people are sitting on every corner with tanks and barbed wire at certain times of the year, and everybody else has to give their guns up. I don't think people should keep their guns, you know. I think, lay down your guns. Listen to me. Lay down your guns. Get rid of them. Fill the barrels with molten lead. Don't squirt it out of them. Put it in. Block them up. You know, use them for paperweights. They kill people.
Well, that's what they were made for.
Yeah.
I mean, some people might tell you, the NRA here might tell you, they're all for self-defense and these criminals that come in through the windows.
Why'd you join the army, man? I wasn't dumb enough to do that, you know? I like guns. Right. I think guns are neat because guns protect you from enemies with guns. You lay down your arms and they can march you right into the gas chamber.
That's what happened in Chile, among other places.
So why did you join the army?
I was drafted.
Well,
I didn't.
I was drafted too. I didn't go.
I joined and did my patriotic duty. I fought the Vietnam War in Germany. I went from bar to bar, from Munich to Stuttgart to Nuremberg, and all throughout Germany.
Some wars just aren't worth fighting on any level, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not worth putting on the uniform for, you know?
Gee, there's someone trying to get in the front door and no one's paying any attention to them.
We'll send someone out.
Appreciate that very much.
But I know, Bob, one of the other things...
could be Sharif.
Yes, that we wanted to talk about today is the infiltration of political groups in this country by the FBI and what's going on with the Irish Freedom Committee, which is a legal organization that raises money for Irish political prisoners. The government here has always been saying that money raised by Irish Americans was being used to purchase weapons over in Ireland or wherever they were bought, that the money raised here was being used for that. And people in this country said no, all the money was being raised for the families of Irish political prisoners. So being the government couldn't prove, because there was no proof, that the money was going for that, so, Bob, they do the next best thing. They send in an FBI agent to join a legal Irish political organization, the Irish Freedom Committee, and he went by the name of Dave Rupert. And Dave joined the Irish Freedom Committee in order to compromise it. I had several meetings with Dave Rupert here in this country, and he tried to persuade me to do things that shouldn't have been done. And on, if you go to irishfreedom.net, you'll see a lot of the emails that we had from the FBI informant as he was trying to recruit members here in New York to do certain things. And I just wanted to read one of them to you. And this is Dave Rupert trying to recruit a member of the Irish Freedom Committee in New York. And he was saying to him, he says, in any case, at this time, we can do one of three things. We can hold a meeting of the board of directors. We can reroute the focus of the organization to what it was intended to be, a loosely knit group of independent units with very small national footprint. Or we can split with John McDonough, Oriented New York Unit, and go ahead and establish this ourselves.
This is from an FBI file, huh?
Yeah. Well, no, actually, this is from an FBI informant's email.
Uh-huh.
He says, we can lose McDonough and a few of the fellows in New York City, but we gain a good number in the city. McDonough's problem is he does not want to give up the name, nor do we. If we talk to him, I would suggest him to keep a certain name, but he won't return my phone calls or emails. We subsequently expelled him for making things like that. But Bobby also was talking about WBAI.
Oh, wait. Mm-hmm. So let's just run that by one more time. Someone came in and tried to entrap you?
Well, and trap the whole organization.
Into some kind of selling or...
Well, misdirecting the money is what he wanted to do. And which
I think, out in
Chicago.
It reminds me of a time down on the Lower East Side when there was a group called the Real Great Society. And they were pretty angry, some of them, about the... I think it was about the occupation of Puerto Rico by the United States. And so this guy shows up and joins the group and tells them where they can get a mortar so that they can blow up the United Nations in protest. And, of course, when this finally... Or maybe it was the Statue of Liberty. I don't remember. But when the thing finally... came to its end, it turned out that this guy was the cop. That's how come he knew where to get the guns.
But they play on your emotions. If there's a particularly sensitive time in Ireland or with bombings and everything, they can come to meetings, these FBI informants, and people wouldn't normally think about certain things, and then you'll have the FBI informant playing on these emotions, getting up at a meeting that we have to do more than what we're doing. We have to take it to another level. And what people have to be reminded is you cannot do that. The government is not only taping your phone calls, they're intercepting all your emails, so don't even think that you're being slick by sending emails. I mean, the emails that I have here are just unbelievable what this FBI informant was trying to do. He's trying to get the databases of everybody's name in Irish Northern Aid so he could use that. So I guess the FBI could do that. And
wait a minute. That sounds a lot like what happened with the JDL when somebody who was close to Mayor Kahana heard a certain poem on WBAI. And he told the FBI that maybe it would be a good idea to make that poem well known to these people who were, you know, would be upset by this poem. And he used the, he was told, please don't use the FBI stationery this time. Don't make this in any way to have come from the FBI. And he wrote this letter saying, this was this letter. It was called the Irving letter. It came up in Daruba's file. It was like two pages stuck together. And the letter said, I am a Negro who, when I was in the army, a Jewish doctor saved my life, so I love the Jewish people, but my son, he's one of those new left radicals, and he hates the Jewish people. So they sent this letter to, people who naively believed that this was a reflection of, you know, more reality than they had known about before, right? And when it was finally revealed, the FBI apologized. Said, yeah, we shouldn't have done that.
But that's, you know, after the damage is done.
Well, after, like, 10 years of damage.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's what they do, you know. That is what they do.
But here's another email that he sent to someone, and he was talking about WBAI.
Right.
And it says here, as for John McDonough, in any case, he would not have much to talk about since he's supporting a group in Ireland called Republican Sinn Féin. I doubt if it was not for the radio station program, he would have any clout at all. If he were so much as even to cross line one in maligning our cause, we would have his station owner in court with the blink of an eye, which would rapidly bring an end to him. So he's already stating out, as an FBI informant, that if we said anything against him, and we were talking bits and pieces about what was going on in the Irish Freedom Committee, that he was telling other members that he was going to bring the station to court. And, you know, it gets far more serious once you find out that he is an FBI informant, and who is currently in the witness protection program. He will be testifying in Ireland against a Michael McKevitt, who's been arrested and he's been charged with membership in an illegal organization and also for directing terrorism, which carries a life sentence.
Michael
McKevitt. So he's in jail now in Ireland based on emails and testimony that he will give in a non-jury court in Dublin. And he's in the witness protection program in this country. Now, he's not testifying in this country, but American taxpayers are paying to keep him in the witness protection program until he testifies probably around January in Dublin. So we're going to have the sight of an American citizen being flown over to Ireland, paid for either by the Irish government or the American government. It's irrelevant at this stage. And then he'll be testifying in a non-jury court. It'll have three judges, so we won't have to worry about him trying to sway a judge, or a jury, I should say, and he'll be testifying against Michael McKevitt. Now, what's come out about this Dave Rupert might shock everyone that he owed $1 million in back taxes, and it'll be very interesting to find out now if the government has written that off so he can give testimony against people in Ireland, who he alleges that he had dealings with, that it's been alleged that he took money from Chicago and gave it to illegal organizations in Ireland. And since this has happened, the Bush administration has now banned three groups from fundraising in this country. One is the Real IRA, the Irish Republican Welfare Association, and the 32 County Sovereignty Committee, two of which are legal organizations in Ireland and England, and raise funds in Ireland and England. But the Bush administration says they can no longer raise funds here. So there's a lawsuit in Washington. And we're hoping the Center for Constitutional Rights will be taking a lawsuit here, because he's also has a visa ban on any of these groups from allowing their members to come in and speak here in this country. And it's a First Amendment lawsuit that will be taken on by the Center for Constitutional Rights
that's
here.
That's a real gag rule.
But you know what? And Bob, here's the irony of it all. We are allowed to have them on WBAI here from Ireland, the people that are banned by the Bush administration. But people like Robert Knight, who's banned, who's not allowed to trespass here at WBAI, we can't have them on the same airways. It's a wonderful country we live in.
So you think that George Bush is responsible for that too, huh?
For what's going on here? No, yeah. I think it's a little closer to home. I don't think we have to go down to Washington.
I've heard that alleged from time to time. You know, who's benefited? It's always the thing to investigate. Wonder if we should take some telephone calls now, or whether
you think people call in?
Do it a bit later. We're at 209 2900. If you want to call and talk to us, I was hoping maybe I would get a call from someone who was on the ground near where that that pizza restaurant was blown up today. That may or may not happen.
Well, there was people from New York injured in that, and I think a woman from New Jersey was killed. But that's when you have political instability. Things like this are going to happen.
You're on the radio.
Hi, I wanted to tell you about something more exciting than blowing up a pizza restaurant.
What could that be?
Well, Mumia Abu-Jamal is going to appear in court on Friday, August 17th, which is Marcus Garvey's birthday. And we're organizing buses to get folks down there. And it's really important for Mumia to be able to see outside
absolutely.
The courtroom window.
Absolutely. Sounds like your telephone is breaking up. Can you talk to us on a hardwired phone?
Hardwired.
You know, like a
hardwired. Is that better?
Much better, yeah.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Anyway, for people to be able to get tickets, which are going to be very reasonable, they can call into 212-330-8029. 330-8029. And it may be the only time that Mumia appears in court because of the Effective Death Penalty Act that was passed. And you know how judges are. Anybody who's been arrested in New York knows it. You sit there and they make up the rules as they go along.
Well, they were pretty upset today, at least in the Ninth Circuit, about the government going in and taking their files. You know about that?
No.
There's some program, the Justice Department program, that is part of Operation Avalanche, where they went out ostensibly against pedophiles all over the world. And they came...
Wasn't that the front page story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they came up with... They came up with material that was taken from judges' computers. Some things that were not part of the trial record, but were, you know, for parole decisions and, you know, all kinds of things that were not supposed to be released.
They pulled
confidential
out everything.
Material. I mean, it's... And the judges said, hey, wait a minute, you know, there is no case law on this at the moment. None. There is none. We're going to make some rulings on this. And we're going to make it a little bit more private in people's hard drives than the government would like it to be, perhaps. So, you know, stay tuned. It's an interesting time.
They should only keep making rules that affect us for the better instead of just making up rules at their own whim. I mean, Mumia is facing this thing where his lawyers put in this thing, a guy admitted to having killed Officer Faulkner. And the judge says, well, it's past the statute of limitations for pending a habeas corpus brief. But there's no statute of limitations on murder. How come the confession has a statute of limitations? But
well,
they make up the laws.
In cases that involve ex-radio personalities...
They make up the laws.
They make up the laws.
I'm telling you.
Ask Frankie Crocker.
Well.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm happy that there's some movement in this area.
Movement? It's going to be mad.
It could be wonderful if it is actually going to be a day in court. But, you know, that it takes more than... our will, it seems, to get
justice.
It's
the first time he's been in court since 1996, This is technically called a status hearing, but it may be to reopen the post-conviction relief appeal that was taking effect in 95 and 96, because there's this whole new bunch of new affidavits, as well as that confession, signed confession, which was corroborated by, what do they call him, a polygraph expert?
His confession.
A guy named Arnold Beverly. Mumia's only confession is that he's innocent. He filed an affidavit saying, I am innocent. That's his confession.
Well, wasn't there someone who had testified against him who could also testified that she had been coerced?
Yes.
And that,
indeed.
I mean, she could probably stand a lie detector test as well. And probably the police who took her confession should be given one.
Indeed.
And they'll probably say that they had been drinking all day. They didn't know what they were doing.
Before and after and during.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much for calling. And if you could tell us where tickets are available and how to get them, that would be good.
I expect them to be available in certain bookstores, but you really got to call the hotline tomorrow for the final word on the distribution, because, you know, we got very little notice and we had to do all the logistics very fast. And this is now called the August 17th Coalition for Mumia. And everything had to be done very fast without enough funding. But the tickets will be available, it will be reasonably priced, and by tomorrow afternoon, everything will be in motion. Just call the hotline.
Okay, give the telephone number again, please.
Absolutely. 212-330-8029. And believe me, several people have been assigned to call back any numbers that are given into that hotline. You call in, you'll get a call back within 12, 18 hours.
I hope it is a massive, massive turnout.
Well, I thank you for doing your part.
Well, thank you.
As you always do. I'm Tibby Brooks.
Well,
from the Coalition.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay.